Succession number 23329, reel 15.
Kalyunga, reel 15.
We knew from Dixie's attitude that the Germans had done something pretty disagreeable and were trying to cover it up with this great display. And we knew the occasion marked something that was pretty revolting. There was a cynical sort of silence, and then Heinrich began to read from a document. And strangely, although I understood very little German, I somehow got the gist of it. And the interpreter read the official translation, and we learned that over 70 prisoners had escaped from Stalag III. 50 had been shot dead while resisting arrest or attempting a further escape after being recaptured. Dead-eye dicks, every shot a bullseye, Toby muttered. And that was the very point that Group Captain Massey had made to the Commandant at Sagan, and we knew it could only have been murder. But we wondered why we'd been told and why there'd been such elaborate precautions against a possible disturbance, when their simplest course would have been not to tell us anything. We wondered whether it was something to do with Nat Lehman's recapture. Right. The whole thing went wrong. The Germans obviously were alerted to the fact that there must have been treachery in their camp. And by accident almost, they got a line when documents were found on a Polish resistance worker who was found dead, that named one of the Germans in the prisoner conspiracy. It wasn't meant to be that particular man. It was somebody with the same name, but the Germans, I suppose, intuitively decided to investigate. The man was actually the camp photographer, and he'd been well involved in the conspiracy. The Germans then picked up a man named Monkhardt, who was Grimson's courier. He was the man who travelled between Tally-ho and wherever Grimson was on the Baltic coast, usually. Monckton was arrested and taken away, and we never heard what happened, but no doubt he was executed, and probably after a great deal of torture. The photographer tried to hang himself with his braces. He was in the cell in the cooler. He was cut down and revived. But he was very afraid of what the Gestapo would do to him and what information they might get out of him. And he said he didn't mind dying, but he didn't fancy dying in the hands of the Gestapo. Could we help? And in fact, the cab doctor provided the poison, and it was smuggled to him, and he took his own life. Dixie's next problem was to save Nat Lehman's neck. And it was a privilege of the camp leader to have a bath in one of the boilers in a disused kitchen in the forelager. Somehow Deans organised it for Lehman to have a bath at the same time. Lehman had not taken his identity discs with him, and the Germans were claiming that he had no connection with the camp and was a spy. So he was in some danger. But Deans was able to provide him with his uniform and his identity disc, and that manoeuvre frustrated the German plan. But unfortunately, Townsend Coles, who had also been caught, presumably trying to board a ship somewhere at Danzig or Stettin perhaps, he'd been brought back to the camp in civilian clothes, and Dixie immediately posted a letter to the protecting power, the Swiss, foreseeing what Townsend Cole's likely fate was. The letter was returned to him the next day, and Townsend Cole's was taken away and executed. Two of the men, Jack Gilbert and Flockhart, succeeded in getting back to England. Lewis was shot dead in Danzig, and Callender also. Of Grimson, nothing has been heard, and it's quite certain that he was executed. Right. Not surprisingly, the atmosphere in the camp became very tense indeed, and there was a great deal of animosity between the Germans and the prisoners. A lot of the Germans who had thought they were safely tucked away, well away from the Russian front, were taken by surprise by the ruthlessness of Tally Ho, really. And then recaptured prisoners had been murdered, and a German had been impelled to commit suicide, and although not a lot was known to the common man, whether prisoner or German guard, enough was known to create a very unpleasant atmosphere. Then at the end of April, two Americans had managed to stay hidden in the forelager after they had had, they'd been on sick parade, I think, and they somehow had, their party had covered up for them, and they had stayed in the forelager, and in the middle of the night they made a bid to escape. Their intention was to cut the main fence and get through, but the searchlight picked them up, and they were pinned down, really, in a little circle of light. The postman who had picked them up with the searchlight would have been entitled to shoot, but he didn't. He spared them. But a German Feldwebel, the sergeant, walked up, put his pistol against the ribs of one of the Americans and simply shot him dead, and surprisingly spared the other one. So there was no doubt, there was a witness, there was no doubt to what he had done. Now, normally, if a prisoner died, whether shot trying to escape or for any other reason, he was given full military honours. But in this case, no doctor was allowed to view the body, and he was taken by four friends, just wrapped in a blanket and buried in a shallow grave in the woods. There was no wreath from the Luftwaffe on this occasion. There was a protest to the commandant, the same man who'd reduced the sentence of Buck Buchanan and his friends, but this time he answered with a warning that a similar fate was likely to be that of anyone else who attempted to escape. On the 30th of April, the American compound had a silence of 3 minutes to honour their dead compatriot. Normally, the American compound just buzzed with noise, but on this occasion, the stillness was almost uneerie, and somehow, although we hadn't intended ourselves to have the 3 minute silence, somehow spontaneously it happened. On the same date, Alan Morris and several others were taken from the compound and locked in the cooler. Obviously the Germans believed them to be the brains of Tally-ho. Morris certainly was, but the others weren't really involved as far as I know. Anyway, although we felt a great anxiety for them, especially as there'd been so much killing of late, that we were, and we were very relieved when we discovered that they'd been transferred to another camp. The commandant sanctioned visits between compounds for sporting activities. We thought he was trying to make amends. Toby put it as flushing the sewer. But soon after that, an American failed to salute him, and the commandant reminded the camp that prisoners were obliged to salute an officer of the detaining power. So six Americans who were wont to sunbathe in the nude just inside the wire took heed of the warning, and they brought their caps with them. And it happened that the commandant and his wife walked along the footpath just on the other side of the fence. So the Americans rose quite unselfconsciously, donned their caps, and carefully saluted in unison. The mild aftermath was a new regulation laying down the minimum dress allowed outside the barracks, and that was translated by Hancock, who took the parade, as John Thomas must be covered. Another American was shot dead on May the 26th at 6 a.m. He was dressed in his pajama trousers and he had a towel around his shoulders. And the sentry who went round unbarring the doors did so a minute or two before time, and the American left the barrack a minute before 6 a.m. The sentry, the postern in the box, looked at his watch, saw that it wasn't quite 6 o'clock, and shot the man in the stomach, and he died shortly afterwards. Again, there was a kind of cover-up, and once again, a sad little procession of Americans into the woods went with the body of their friend in a blanket, and again was almost furtively buried. It was a German court of inquiry, and they pronounced that the man had been shot while attempting to escape. The sentry perhaps had gone home on leave and found perhaps that the bombers had wrecked his home or something, and one never knew why men did what they did, but there was probably that kind of an explanation. Most of us laughed when a notice was posted in which all prisoners in possession of arms or ammunition were warned to surrender them at once. It seemed absurdly silly that we should have arms and ammunition, but there were men in tally-ho who did. On the morning of June the 6th, 1944, Toby woke up and promptly said, "I dreamed about lots of little invasion barges swarming like spring leaves on an elm." Toby always had a nice turn of phrase. Everybody laughed. We'd waited for a invasion day for so long, but he persisted. "Invasion today," he said, "sure as God made little toadstools." And so when somebody came back to the barrack with the news that there was an invasion, Toby was quite patronising, really. "What did Mrs. Tobias's bright little boy say?" he babbled. Well, we looked at Jimmy Poynter, who being the first with the news, and it took him quite some time to get it out. He was so excited. Eventually he said, "Fellas, it's on." And so we all raced out, and there was a notice on the notice board. It was under the heading of our local newspaper, the Daily Reco, but the words were actually had been given officially by the Germans, just reporting that the invasion had started. It didn't really say anything more except that bitter fighting was in progress. At this point, maps began to appear on barrack walls, rather like briefing room maps with coloured pins and lines of wool of various colours, and they couldn't be as up to date as we would have liked, because that would have betrayed the Canary as the source of the information. So we simply had to follow the German newspapers and announcements. There was a tremendous flow of anticipation and optimism, but especially when Rome had also fallen. But then the flying bombs began, and prisoners who had thought their homes and families were safe now became rather worried. In the earlier, right now, perhaps miraculously, there had never been a fire in any of our camps, but in the early hours of June the 13th, we heard cries of fire around the camp. We heard feet running past the windows. Somebody had been pretty brave, because it's surprising that they weren't bumped off. But anyway, people swarmed out of the windows. The doors, of course, were barred from the outside. And there were really too many of us, and the guards didn't really know what to do. But we quickly found all the buckets we could, and in our pajamas we rushed out and set up a chain, and the buckets were passed along and passed up to Ken Bowden and Jack Lipton, who were standing rather precariously on the roof of the next hut, just a few feet away from the theatre, which was where the fire was. The theatre was wooden, and the ceiling was tarred paper, so it was very inflammable indeed. There were flames everywhere, and we were worried not so much about the theatre, but the nearby hut where the library, Dixie's office and sleeping quarters were, and also a store of 9 million cigarettes, a quantity which had really staggered the Gestapo on their recent visit. The bucket chains from the washhouse went on. German firemen arrived, but they stood gazing at the fire, and they their hoses looked as if they'd been dry cleaned and pressed, quite pristine, but no water came. So we were dependent entirely on the bucket chain. Ken Bowden and Jack Lipton had quite an amusing time, because as they hurled the water across the intervening space, only about 12 or 15 feet, occasionally they got rather wild in their flaming, and they managed to soak several German officers and NCOs, twice sousing Heinz, who was a particularly loathsome specimen. Then quite suddenly the fire hoses, which everybody had forgotten, suddenly spouted water from the nozzles. The first jet hit a rather stout German officer between the eyebrows. He fell flat on his back, and the man who was holding the hose was so absolutely flabbergasted with what he'd done that he kept the hose on him. Anyway, soon the fire fizzled out or burned itself out, and so the theatre was gone. And next morning, the only item which was recovered from the ashes was a gramophone record. It was "I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire," sung by Vera Lynn. The loss of the theatre hit most of us pretty hard. One remembered all the work that had gone into building it, converting a ordinary wooden hut. There were seats made from Red Cross boxes, and there was a stage and a simple proscenium, and so much had gone on there. Lots of plays and debates, and Frank Hunt's orchestra and the two popular orchestras, and even the church services. So much seemed to have been lost. Little did we know that in fact it had been deliberate. In a cupboard backstage, where the electricians and the tailors worked, there was an amplifying set presented by the Swedish YMCA, and every time this was used, the cupboard had to be locked by the Germans. The cause of the fire was thought to have been an electrical fault, but in fact, earlier in the night, the theatre had been broken into, the cupboard forced open, and equipment which was needed to keep the canary going was removed to hide the evidence. An ingenious time bomb was placed, and that was how the theatre came to burn. Many people said that was its best performance. In day, July the 1st, the Canadians from K-Lager were allowed to visit our compound. In fact, all the denizens of K-Lager were allowed to visit the compound. And I was able to talk to T.B. Miller, my friend from early prisoner of war days. And the next time I saw him was 9 years later, when Dixie told me that there was a student at London School of Economics, where Dixie worked, a Canadian who had been in our camp and was named Miller. So I rang the Canadian High Commission and asked if they would send on a letter if I sent it to them. And the woman who answered the phone it turned out to be Tom Miller's wife. So I didn't have to write the letter. We met and we've been great friends ever since. For a few weeks, life in the camp went on without incident. There were long days with lots of sunshine. There was an epidemic of fleas. But otherwise, little happened of note. But then, suddenly we realized that Russia was thrusting very powerfully towards us. And of course, the rumors began that we were to move. Then we thought it was too late, the Russians were too close. But they weren't. The Germans intended to move us, we thought they didn't have much time, and we were sure the Russians would bomb the bridge at Tilsit,